Welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Thursday, creating an emissions reduction scheme that keeps the business sector on side has brought a string of politicians undone over the last 15 years. But that's exactly what Energy Minister Chris Bowen is grappling with right now. And single parents are calling for an overhaul of the tax system to force former partners who owe child support to pay up.
I actually caught him working for cash in a shop. And I said something, I was like quite upset because I was working full time. He was working for cash on Newstart, paying his $7 a fortnight or whatever in child support for our child.
First today, as the East Coast flooded earlier this year, everyday heroes came to the rescue. They weren't wearing capes, but they came in their tinnies, and in the dead of night they rescued their neighbours. Now the New South Wales Flood Inquiry has found these heroes and their mates need to be trained to help out again next time. The report recommends a community first responders program, which includes funding equipment for emergencies and training by appropriate government agencies. Catherine Gregory reports.
They're known as the Tinny Flotilla, the group of Lismore locals who navigated floodwaters to rescue people stranded in their homes. 15-year-old Lockie Conlon is one of them. He and his cousin, Henry Allen, took off in their boat early on that fateful morning.
Yeah, and then we woke up and to his sister coming into his room, showing us all the photos on Facebook and how they were asking for people to get down there with boats. So we hooked ours on and just went down.
He reckons they rescued about 40 people.
Some of them were on their roofs, but in the shallower parts, there were people still in their houses. And my cousin had to walk through it while I held the boat and go in and find them, because you could hear them asking for help. Most of them were crying. And
Lockie Conlon says while he wasn't scared at the time, some of the rescues were pretty challenging.
The hardest part was getting them from the water into the boat, like especially the elderly, because some of them had to swim out of their homes and then try climbing.
Aidan Ricketts is another Lismore local who rescued about 22 people. Luckily, he did so with a long-held boat licence and a fair bit of experience on the water. Still, for him, the main challenge was the dirty water.
In terms of visibility, you cannot see anything under the water at all. So consequently, you know, your big hazard is hitting things. So whether that's submerged vehicles, carports, even in the case of this flood, submerged power lines. I mean, normally try to use the streets as your navigation ways. So the next set of hazards is things like, you know, give way signs in the middle of roads. And
one of the key recommendations from the inquiry into the 2022 New South Wales floods was to train up people who live in flood-prone areas to do these sorts of rescues. The report says there should be a community first responders program, which includes funding equipment for the community and training by appropriate government agencies. Aidan Ricketts mostly supports the idea.
Look, the community's got an advantage over the government when it comes to immediate disaster rescue, partly because it has greater granularity, it has greater local knowledge. But look, the other thing I really point to is, you know, the safety paralysis that the government agencies tend to have in a disaster. And the thing about your community rescuers is, you know, we look at it very differently. Look, it's a life-threatening situation and we're out there reducing the risk by saving people. It's like, yes, of course you're being as safe as you can be, but you're not hamstrung by a kind of a bureaucratic safety paralysis. You know, I think that's a really important thing to recognise about why the community can be more effective.
Greg Mullins is with the Emergency Leaders for Climate Action and is the former Commissioner for Fire and Rescue New South Wales. He also supports the recommendation.
The experience here and overseas is that on the worst days of fires, floods, cyclones, there may not be any emergency responders. So the community does need to know what to do. We saw that in Lismore.
Are there any concerns, though, that it might cause further problems? You know, people might end up hurting themselves.
We send heavy rescue teams overseas to help after earthquakes, and part of their training is leveraging what they call spontaneous volunteers, because they do most of the rescues. So if the focus is on giving them enough knowledge to keep themselves safe, they're going to help out anyway, no matter what government does. So it's great to have a program where the emergency services give them that basic knowledge so that they won't become victims themselves. And again, with climate change, we're going to see more and more of these disasters, so people need to be prepared.
Greg Mullen says now more than ever, this training is needed, given less people are volunteering for services like the SES. And he adds that flood rescue systems could learn a bit from bushfire preparedness.
Look, there's a proven program in bushfires already where people in urban areas are trained up. They have basic equipment. They're not firefighters, but they wet down before the fire arrives. They prepare the homes for impact, cleaning gutters, etc., flammable material. It's very, very successful.
Dr. Barbara Ryan is from the University of Southern Queensland and specialises in disaster communication. She thinks community members could have another role beyond frontline rescues.
So for me, the standout from the whole process was that the localised nature of communication and community engagement has been lost to some extent, and there is scope to have volunteers from the community skilled in those areas that, you know, have local knowledge, and if they're given specialised training in communication and community engagement according to what the SES needs and the inquiry is shown as required, could be really valuable in that sort of situation.
Dr. Barbara Ryan from the University of Southern Queensland, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. Australia's biggest emitters will be watching closely as Labor considers changes to pollution caps that were brought in by the previous government. It's part of Labor's plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 43% by the end of the decade. Labor says Australia's biggest emitters have it too easy, and it comes as a report finds we're not on track to reach our climate targets. Angus Randall reports.
In a few weeks' time, Australia will have a climate emissions target enshrined in law, 43% by 2030. Figuring out how to reach that target is the task of Energy and Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen. He'll be talking with the big end of town about emission caps, which were dubbed safeguards by the previous government.
28% of Australia's emissions are covered by safeguard facilities, and as I said, we're not going to reduce emissions as a country unless we reduce them from our biggest emitters.
The emissions safeguard places limits on Australia's 215 biggest polluters, who each emit more than 100,000 tonnes of greenhouse gases per year. This group includes coal mines, aluminium smelters, manufacturing plants, and airlines. Here's how it works. Each company is allocated a set amount of emissions they can produce. If they go above that limit, they must buy carbon offsets. If they stay under their cap, they can sell the remaining amount to other companies that may be struggling to meet their commitments. But Chris Bowen says after 6 years, emitters are sitting well under their cap, meaning they've not had any reason to take stronger climate action.
The baselines are set in many instances above existing emissions, and that's why the system so far, the safeguards policy, has failed. Emissions have gone up from facilities covered by the safeguard mechanism since it was introduced by the last government in 2016. So we're keeping the architecture because the architecture is quite elegant, but the actual way it was implemented was very, very poor.
Companies may have their emissions cap reduced by up to 6% each year in order to reach the 2030 target. The government will need to make a call on how that emissions threshold is calculated. For example, can the threshold be raised if a company increases production, or will it have to make do with the same limit? Chris Bowen says he's yet to make a decision. Alison Reeve is the Deputy Director of the Climate Change and Energy Program at the Grattan Institute. She says both have their advantages and challenges.
An absolute cap, it doesn't necessarily stop business growth, but it does mean that a business has to change its operations in order to grow. It can't just increase its speed of production, so to speak. The risk of the other approach, which is called an intensity approach, is that while the company might be producing fewer emissions per unit of whatever product it produces, if it is producing many more units of that product, overall emissions will go up, which is what we don't want.
Industry has largely supported proposed changes to the emissions safeguard. Alison Reeve says those companies just want clarity.
Industry has been asking for a clearer signal about where emissions are going and what they're expected to do for a long time. Facilities in this sector have very long lifetimes, and so that means when you make an investment decision, it's a major decision and it locks in a pattern of emissions and a pattern of liability for those emissions for a long period of time. So they want as much certainty as they can get going forward on how fast they are expected to reduce the emissions intensity of their production.
One area of concern for industry is how an Australian company that has to meet these targets can compete with a foreign counterpart that doesn't. Tennant Reid is the Director of Climate Change and Energy at the Australian Industry Group.
Are they going to be able to stay competitive with their counterparts overseas? Now, the world is moving on climate change, but it's moving in a messy way. Many policies, many speeds in different countries. So this issue of trade competitiveness, it's different to what it was 10 years ago, but it's still relevant. And that's going to be one of the major focuses.
A new report says change may need to come sooner to meet those 2030 targets. Climate change advisory firm Endeavour Environmental says that without significant change, by 2030, Australia will have emitted 900 million tonnes of carbon above its targets. Jennifer Rayner is head of advocacy for the Climate Council. She says she'll be pushing to ensure no industry gets a free ride.
Industry's involvement and engagement with this mechanism is going to be really important because we do have to recognise that these are big industries that will be affected by this policy. What we do recognise, though, is that the heavy industry and their lobbyists are going to be in an absolute feeding frenzy through this process to avoid making a meaningful contribution. So we do need to stay focused on the fact that this mechanism can deliver the cleaner, future-proofed industry capable of sustaining Australian jobs if we get it right.
Both sides of politics have committed to reaching net zero emissions by 2050. However, they differ considerably on what needs to be done to reach that target. The talks with industry will end in late September, and changes could come in next July.
Angus Randall. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Australian parents are calling for an overhaul of the tax system to force recalcitrant former partners who owe child support to pay up. Social services groups have joined the chorus, saying tens of thousands of parents have skipped child support payments, with up to $2 billion now outstanding. They say parents avoid the child support payments by either failing to lodge a tax return or moving payments through trusts and partnerships. Stephanie Smale reports.
For some single parents, the fight to get financial support for their child can take years. This mother, who doesn't want to be named, says her former partner went to great lengths to avoid sharing his earnings.
I actually caught him working for cash in a shop with a logoed shirt on, and it was just by chance that I walked into this shop and I said something. I was like quite upset because I was working full time and here I am giving our child a better future, and he was working for cash on Newstart, paying his $7 a fortnight or whatever in child support for our child.
She explains the system has eventually worked for her, with both of her children now getting some support. But she says there were often lengthy delays, and she has to work hard to make sure her children have what they need.
I had to work really hard, minimum wage jobs for long hours or multiple jobs. I was like, not going to let them go without. There were years in between sometimes, and I, at one point when he was quite young, like early primary school, I just sort of gave up. And I remember my family saying to me, like, no, like, you deserve that. And, you know, my son deserves that. But it sort of gets to the point where it's like you're better off just following your own path.
The National Council of Single Mothers and Their Children says there are obvious ways to target parents who aren't supporting their children financially.
We are saying to the child support system, make sure that the person who is presenting their information has lodged a tax return. That would stop the problem immediately.
The council's CEO, Therese Edwards, argues tax returns should be demanded from parents who owe child support to make sure their children don't miss out.
The group who are looking after their children, they actually have to lodge, or they miss out on money that is critical for their economic survival. But we have the ATO that is allowing mostly men not to lodge, and then we have the child support system that sort of throws their hands up. And I don't understand why there's not greater scrutiny on this.
About 1 million Australian children should be receiving child support, but Therese Edwards says too many missing tax returns means their parents can avoid sharing their money with them.
So we know that we have a couple of hundred thousand that have an outstanding tax return of 2+ years. We also know that we have a further 16,000 that haven't returned a tax return in over 10 years. So the figures are known, they're available, and they're deeply disturbing.
How much child support is outstanding in Australia at the moment?
So the official figure is it's just a tad under $1.7 billion, but that is a complete underrepresentation. So there are two types of child support agreements, and debt is only collected in one of those child support agreements, and it is not the most popular one. So it's a really airbrushed figure, because it also doesn't include things like written off debts that are forgiven. So it's not an accurate figure. So even though it is a mind-blowing figure, and you think of the hardship and poverty that children are experiencing in sole parent families, and you know immediately what that would do, we also know that that is a complete underestimation. And the not lodging the tax returns is part of that underestimation.
Anti-Poverty Week Executive Director Tony Wren says funding cuts have made it harder for the tax office to pursue parents who owe child support. But she argues the Albanese government can make the changes that are necessary.
Well, the ATO has been acting to try and collect these amounts, but unfortunately, the previous government actually reduced the amount of money that was provided to them to help them do that. So we're calling for this government to really take on this challenge. We don't think it's too hard. Single parents and their children have the highest poverty rates in Australia, and that's just not acceptable. We have got the means to make their lives better.
A spokesman for the Assistant Treasurer, Stephen Jones, says staff have met with the National Council of Single Mothers and their Children to discuss the issue.
Stephanie Smale reporting there. The United States is investigating the case of a Saudi woman who's been jailed for 34 years for resharing tweets that were critical of Saudi authorities. The woman, who's studying at a British university, has been accused of destabilising national security by retweeting other people's posts. Human rights activists have condemned the sentence and say work to free women in Saudi Arabia is far from over. Isabel Rowe reports.
2 years ago, Saudi mother Salma Al-Shabaab was at Leeds University in the UK studying for her PhD. Now she's starting a decades-long jail sentence for resharing tweets critical of the Saudi government.
34 years in prison for supporting dissidents and activists on Twitter is an extremely harsh prison sentence, even in the context of Saudi Arabia.
Amnesty International campaigner Nikita White blames this woman's jail term on a relaxation of international pressure on Saudi Arabia. Reports from international media say Saudi authorities arrested the mother of two in 2020 when she returned from the UK to visit family. Her initial sentence was 3 years for using a website to cause public unrest. But after an appeal, her sentence was lengthened earlier this week. Her crimes described as destabilising civil and national security. Nikita White believes it's part of a worrying backward trend in women's rights.
Women still face a raft of discrimination in Saudi Arabia. They still need men's permission to do a lot of the things that most women around the world take for granted. Although there has been pressure from other governments, that pressure has waned in recent years. And so what we're seeing is an increase in people being detained in Saudi Arabia, and also the length of sentences.
Reports suggest Salma Al-Shabaab wasn't a well-known social media user. She had about 2,500 followers on Twitter and would occasionally reshare tweets from Saudi dissidents or Saudi feminists. The Guardian reports that when an official Saudi government account tweeted about some new public transport, Salma Al-Shabaab responded with, "Finally." That tweet allegedly attracted abuse from another Saudi account a year later, a month before she was detained. United States State Department spokesman Ned Price has announced an investigation.
We are studying the case, we are studying the sentence, but I can say this as a general matter, and I can say this without any caveat and resolutely. Exercising freedom of expression to advocate for the rights of women should not be criminalized. It should never be criminalized.
Despite the United States' interest, Nikita White says it's US President Joe Biden's recent visit with the Saudi Crown Prince that may have emboldened local authorities.
We saw that women and a lot of other activists were released shortly following Biden's election, and that's not a coincidence. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this incredibly long sentence has been handed down not long after Biden's conciliatory visit with Mohammed bin Salman. So it is really important that the West doesn't forget these women.
Last week, a US court convicted a former Twitter employee of spying for Saudi Arabia by handing over personal information of Twitter users who were critical of the government and the Crown Prince.
Isabel Rowe. Scientists have long known the important role that T cells play in fighting infections in the human body. But now the discovery of a new population of immune cells which are related to T cells has raised hope of further boosting the body's ability to fight. The findings by Australian and German researchers show these newly found cells work to prevent exhaustion in T cells and could be a breakthrough in the fight against cancer and other infections. Sarah Sedgie reports.
Hiding amongst the trillions of cells in the body, a finding with huge promise.
Well, these cells have been inferred to exist, but, you know, really putting your finger on how this works and why this works, that was not really clear. And this is where we come in.
Immunologist Professor Axel Carles from the Doherty Institute is among the researchers to make the discovery of a new type of cell. In the body, T cells help fight infections and cancer. But for some people who've been sick for a long time, the T cells can tire. Professor Carles and his team found a new cell within the T-cell family that helps prevent T-cells from tiring.
T-cells are well-known immune cells that are really important for fighting virus infections and tumours and so forth. And they've been known for a long time, but what we discovered is how these T-cells can be maintained over a very long time. And this is particularly important in the context of persistent or chronic infections or tumour growth. Usually T-cells are sort of designed to act fast and hard. And if you have a common cold, for example, they are really efficient and do that really well. But in these long conditions such as chronic infection or cancer, there's a phenomenon that is called immune exhaustion, where these cells really lose their edge and lose their function. And what we discovered is a cell type that acts like a stem cell for these killer T cells that are so important.
So in a healthy person, are these cells working away, suppressing any tumours, suppressing infection? But when people get severely sick and they experience that exhaustion, those cells just aren't working as effectively?
Yeah, that's the idea. So I think these cells are working quite well in most cases, but as you know, certain infections such as HIV or long-term diseases such as cancer can be, they go on for years, and this is where these cells really start becoming exhausted and not working as well as they should. And also, you know, there is an assumption that it's not the same in every person. Some people respond quite well to immunotherapies, others don't. And one of the ideas is that these cells are different between different people. And this is obviously something we have to look at very carefully now.
While the research is in the preclinical phase, the hope is this knowledge will be used to find a way to manipulate exhausted cells in people who are sick through new therapies. This could take some time, but Professor Carles is confident researchers are on the right track.
Well, I think it's very big because, if you have a hypothesis, that's all well and good and you can sort of start working based on it. But you need to have ways of identifying the right cell type that actually matters in therapy or in disease. And if you can do that, then that's a really important step forward in actually, manipulating these cells, trying to improve them or perhaps even to inhibit them, for example, some conditions of autoimmunity. So there's lots of different conditions where these cells should play a role, and now we can really, in a very targeted manner, try to work with that.
The research has been published in the scientific journal Nature.
Sarah Sedgie reporting. And that's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. David Lipson and the PM crew will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. I'm Rachel Mealy. Thanks for your company. Have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Scott Morrison says he was sworn into multiple ministries for the good of the Australian people. But does that fit the facts? Today, Insider's host David Spears, what we're learning now about the motives of the man who was our leader for almost 4 years. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.